Welcome to the Guffman. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James.
Thank you for welcoming me.
Oh, you're quite welcome, James. Before we get started, check out our website, themcguffman.com. Our more recent episodes have been about The Social Network, Creed, Borat, and Psycho. And I also wrote a thing about Adele and Justin Bieber and Shia LaBeouf. So themcguffman.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, at themcguffman. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Tell your friends.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes?
The day is here. The day you and I both waited 30 years for.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Or 30 plus years, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, 32.
There you go. Yeah. We've almost been alive for that long. Yeah, isn't it nice that it worked out, like the timing between the production of the movies and their relation to each other? The first and third trilogy, that is.
Yes, of course. Sure, yeah. And we're off to a great start.
Showing that passion we all know we love you for.
Yeah, exactly. What movie are we talking about here today, James?
About Star Wars, The Force Awakens.
Yes.
Number one of the third trilogy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, everybody knows what this movie is. How'd you like it?
I did like it. Yeah. I think I liked it more than you, even though I don't know how you feel about it. but I was more... optimistic for this movie than you were anyway, so that might have something to do with it.
Yeah,
but I liked it. I thought, it's a Star Wars movie. It had to do a lot of things as far as appealing to people who are fans of the original trilogy and reaching new people who might not have seen them, likely because they were too young, and still be entertaining, and a combination of new and old, and I think they did a good job of it. It's by no means world-changing art, but it I did enjoy it. I did. Okay. How did you feel about it?
I enjoyed it. I was actually disappointed by it. I thought it would be better than it was. I described it as exceedingly okay. You know, like
yeah.
And as somebody that, as a kid, definitely really liked two of the Star Wars movies a lot. It just, I don't know. Like, I thought the first half was good. And then my buddy Tanya pointed this out to me. It just, like, the second half just really gives in to the whole Star Wars referencing Star Wars thing. And that was kind of where it sort of started to become less interesting to me. It just sort of started to fold in on itself, you know, and it just wasn't that interesting. I didn't find any of the action sequences all that engaging. The whole thing kind of felt not very well directed, which was kind of a bummer because I have pointed this out on the podcast before. I do think J.J. Abrams is talented. I just feel like the weight of Star Wars took away the ability to use some of his talent. But just in general, I don't know. There was just something that felt the movie, and I'm sure I've said this about a Marvel movie or something, it felt more like the obligations got in the way of filmmaking, you know?
Yeah, I can see that. And I mean, there's a couple different ways to, I think, look at that problem. It could be that it's just too derivative, especially of A New Hope, which I'm definitely on the side of agreeing with that. It's just very similar to that movie in a lot of ways. You know, is it too much that it's just going through the same beats, that it's kind of just on the rails of A New Hope? Mm-hmm. Or is it spending a lot of time doing what you described of, you know, referencing Star Wars and it turned into too much of a checklist? You know, give everybody their entrances, give the Millennium Falcon its entrance. Yeah. Is it too much of a checklist or is it just too much of a retread?
It's too much of a retread. Now, I will say character introductions. those always work for me. It seems to be like regardless of who the character is, like if you just reintroduce them well, it just makes me happy. Like I've said this about 24 before, I feel like the reason I watched the whole series run of that show is to watch them reintroduce Jack Bauer every year, just because it's like some big dramatic reveal that he's not dead, you know, the Chinese government let him out. And I felt like pretty much all of them in Star Wars were good. 3PO's being a certain highlight.
His red arm.
Well, no, him popping into frame okay. And interrupting Han and Leia. I thought that was really funny.
Yes, very, very 3PO.
Yeah, exactly, because that was the one where you couldn't anticipate the character that was showing up there, too, yeah. Right? Because like you, as that introduction starting, you're like, oh, this is where Leia's going to show up. You can tell by how Han's reacting, and it just makes sense with what we know about the character. And then C-3PO just wedges his way in there, and I thought that was really, really funny and a really clever way to do that. Yeah. So that type of thing, like weirdly, will just always make me happy, regardless of my attachment to the character. The retread thing was what bothered me. Like it just felt like so much just being redone, and I haven't seen A New Hope in about 10 years, probably. But it's just like, okay, I know what's happening here. I know these beats. And, you know, I was thinking about it some more and like, I think it's kind of not necessarily, you know, it's kind of antithetical to the Star Wars thing. 'Cause Star Wars starts with George Lucas actually wanting to make a Flash Gordon movie and trying to buy the rights to Flash Gordon. And it was just easier for him to do something new that was kind of like Flash Gordon, and make that movie. And that's how you get Star Wars. It's this old idea that he then has to do in a new way, and Star Wars is just this old idea that's mostly done in the old way, you know, and I'm talking The Force Awakens specifically, right. And that was that's an idea that I feel like permeates through the whole movie or runs through the whole movie, and the thing that bothered me the most about the movie, you know. And I will point out that I certainly am in the minority on this. Judging by the audience I saw it with, especially judging by the person sitting next to me who was like fist pumping the whole movie, and people applauding and stuff, like I know I'm in the minority, and I know this movie is specifically designed to play to people that just want the new old thing, and that's not me in filmmaking, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I'm aware. Yeah,
I feel like we have what 230 plus episodes of evidence of this.
Yeah, more than that, I think. But anyway, yeah, I mean, it was, it's funny when every time they mention Jakku, it's, just call it Tatooine.
Yeah.
We know what's going on. It's the desert planet with the poor people where everything starts, and it's terrible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, but I mean, yeah, we get our cantina scenes, we get our, you know, the sand planet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is a lot of the same beats, but... To go back to something you said about this being so antithetical to Star Wars, to do something old in to do something new in an old way, not to do something old in a new way, really. Mm-hmm. There's such a theme of families in the Star Wars, you know, cinematic universe. Yeah. You know, we have these. Because of the very unique and odd way that these movies were made, which starting 4, 5, 6 as a trilogy, then, you know, needing to do 1, 2, 3 as another trilogy, and then the announcement that these are going to be 3 movies, you know, 7, 8, 9, and, you know, some other things leaking out the sides of them, but whatever. And that there's just this theme of, you know, these cycles and these families. You know, we have the first trilogy being Anakin's story, the, you know, chronologically speaking, you know, episodes 1, 2, 3 being Anakin's story, mm-hmm. 4, 5, 6 being Luke's story, and presumably 7, 8, 9 being a descendant of Luke's story, we'll say. Mm-hmm. Is it that crazy that they are, you know, these three little sets of movies telling a very similar story?
No, it's not. But I mean,
it's just a generational thing. We have a grandfather, and then you know, his son, and presumably another child.
So what you're saying is our generation the ones that get 1, 2, and 3. We're the garbage generation. Yeah,
the garbage middle.
Our midichlorian count is off the charts because it's so low.
That word is not in use anymore. No, I come across it too, and I am kind of playing mostly devil's advocate here because I'm not trying to say that we should just repeat movies or trilogies over and over, but there is this theme of repetition and cycles and, you know, family generations and going through similar stories. I don't know that it's so out of left field to do it this way, in the way that you said Lucas just wanted to make Flash Gordon and only didn't because he couldn't. It's not because he wanted to change filmmaking, mm-hmm. even though that was a result of it. Hmm. I don't know that it's so out of left field to do something not incredibly groundbreaking when it's an exercise in making it as new as it has to be, not as it can be.
Yeah. I guess the things that you're describing are just the things that I kind of find boring about it, you know, because at least from a filmmaking standpoint is where I'm sort of looking at it from, you know, more than the actual story of the movie, where from filmmaking and I suppose story, because the story is the filmmaking in this movie, because it's just such a propulsive movie. And that's one of the things that was influential about A New Hope, is that it was a movie that started and then let up when the credits were rolling, you know?
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, you can continue.
No, I was just, as much as people are so amped up about Luke appearing at the end of this one. Oh, spoiler in all this.
Oh, of course.
I'm kidding.
If you listened to 10 minutes of this and somehow didn't think there was going to be a spoiler coming, you're a big old dummy.
I'm joking. Luke isn't what we like about A New Hope. You know what I mean? It wasn't this really cool character, as much as maybe people pretended to be Luke when playing with their friends after seeing it. He's largely still the whiny kid we make fun of.
It's, yeah, exactly.
We like Han. We like Bob. We like Boba Fett.
Boba Fett's not in A New Hope, you idiot.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
This is getting so contentious so quickly. I love it.
The friendship will be over in 35 minutes.
But it's just to agree with you that it's just this movie that is... it's just nonstop. It's just things are happening and then it's building and things keep going. And then, starting from that first blast of music, it doesn't really let up that much. Mm-hmm. And as you said, it is more about the filmmaking than it is about Luke.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess it's just like, I don't know. I guess I'm like partially agreeing with what you're saying and just annoyed by it, you know, like not you specifically saying it, just that this is the movie that I concur that there is a theme of generations running through the movies. There's never been my favorite thing about it. As you pointed out, Luke is nobody's real favorite character in these movies. The whole thing just felt kind of tired in this one, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
And I just would have liked to see something a bit more inventive.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I understand what you're saying.
It felt like a movie that was afraid of its legacy. It was afraid to do anything like big. And I thought it was going to do something big in some capacity, just because I knew J.J. Abrams wouldn't, would want to leave his sort of J.J. Abramsy stamp, which is to, in this case, kill Han Solo. But, you know, even that moment kind of hit with a thud, even though, you know, we never hear his body land, I suppose. It just, I don't know, like that was the thing, the one thing that he did to sort of, and I know, you know, Ben Kenobi dies in A New Hope as well, but this was a killing off an established character, not somebody that was established 110 minutes ago, you know? And one of the most beloved movie stars of all time, and probably his second most beloved character at worst, you know?
After What Lies Beneath.
Yeah, exactly. That Robert Zemeckis really tapped into a cultural vein with that one. And it just like that was the moment where he kind of stumbled a bit, and it was the only moment where he kind of tried something that I could have been like, oh, that's interesting and kind of courageous of you, where you don't feel crushed by the legacy of the franchise that you are now in charge of, you know? And that it just didn't really work to me. Or didn't really, you know, hit me in any sort of emotional capacity. I think really colored the rest of the movie. And yeah, I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I get that. And I've,
and it amplified all of the other, like, you know, copy or not, you know, more cookie cutter elements of the rest of the movie, just because the one thing where he tried something kind of courageous didn't work.
Yeah.
For me.
Well, we even get Han addressing the fact that we're up against just what is essentially a bigger Death Star.
Yeah, yeah, that is true.
you know, just to talk about kind of retreading. How did you feel about, I mean, that plot point? It's kind of less central to the plot than the first Death Star was. Do you think that there was too much stuff packed into this movie? Is that part of the checklist problem?
I mean, I always feel like there's too much stuff packed into these movies. I think it's pretty, like, Oscar Isaac just disappears for, what is it, an hour of this movie, and then just comes back out of nowhere. Just because, like, they didn't have time to give him anything to do in the intervening minutes, you know? And I think that's kind of a... And I know that this movie is kind of about Han Solo, and Oscar Isaac's probably about to be the new Han Solo in these new movies, so they kind of had to let say goodbye to the old one, give him enough time first. But I think that is part of, like, certainly something that shows that it is a little bit overstuffed, you know?
Okay, but what they at least held off on Luke.
That is true, and that was something I was impressed by. And I thought that was cool that just finding Luke is the whole driving force of the movie. That I don't have a lot of complaints about that.
Okay, yeah, because yeah. I mean, just even before this movie had come out, you can kind of predict what some of the backlash is going to be, and that, you know, a lot of it.
I would like to make sure that my criticism is noted as criticism and not backlash, because okay. I don't want to be backlash. I want to be criticism.
Fine. That's fair. No, but I mean, I speak of, you know, kind of more broadly of people who judging this movie before they'd even seen it, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, that everything was going to come too quickly. There'd be too much stuff in it. But yeah, I too was impressed by kind of the patience that they had with Luke, not even giving him any dialogue, him just appearing so late and kind of being... You know, even more than a MacGuffin, not something that takes, you know, 90 minutes to get to and then is played with for 20 minutes. It's so late in the movie, and you don't really get, you know, the payout for it. You just see him, which again is kind of a payout for a lot of these characters and vehicles. That, you know, that's enough. But I was impressed by, you know, just holding that back and giving it. Leaving something out and giving something else to kind of look forward to of the old things and not just jamming everything in.
Yeah. Yes, I concur. And yeah, actually the only criticism I have of that moment is I hate the last shot of this movie. I think it's such like a whatever sort of shot where they just cut to a helicopter shot floating or flying around Luke and Rey.
Yeah.
It's kind of the first wide shot we've seen in a while. It just feels so out of place and terrible. But yeah, other than that, I pretty much completely agree with you. Yeah, they definitely do show some good restraint with Luke.
Okay, and I mean, did you feel that they didn't do enough to establish Rey and Finn, that they kind of got lost in, I mean, in Poe, I guess?
I think they were, well, not the, I mean, they don't establish Poe. They, you know, like, there's no establishment with him. It's like, oh, he's just a guy that knows Max von Sydow, you know? That's pretty much the...
the Max von Sydow that could have played in The Exorcist without makeup.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I thought the Rey and Finn's sort of setup, all that stuff was really good. Those are the things I liked about this movie, were when, you know, when they... well, when Finn first takes off his helmet and pretty much until Han Solo and Chewie show up, I feel like the movie is at its strongest then, because it's the newest that it is to me, you know, like it's these two new characters. And, even though Rey is very obviously meant to be the Luke of this movie, she's doing things that Luke didn't do right off the bat, you know, like she's not a little ween, you know, like she's she's supporting herself, and we see her be a talented bow staff person, you know, I suppose.
Yeah.
And yeah, all of that stuff I thought was really good. And just the idea of a stormtrooper taking off their helmet, that by itself was interesting. The fact that the stormtroopers are humans, all of that stuff was good. And it's all sandwiched into maybe a 30-minute portion before Han and Chewie show up, you know?
Yeah, I think some of the kind of most well-crafted filmmaking is in that front 30. And I think Rey looking through that downed Star Destroyer and grappling through that, and even just her putting on the helmet and eating it, I thought that was all really strong, like stronger than I anticipated it to be.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah, and it looked good visually, and it kind of really quietly, I don't know if it fleshed out a character, but at least introduced and started building a character in a way that was new and was fully a new person, even though, as you said, it's clearly this is going to be our Luke going forward. You know, I think that was kind of walking that tightrope of, you know, referencing things from the old movie, even kind of having it made clear that this is our new version of an old thing, but done in a way that's not just pure callbacks and is, I think, visually entertaining, because I thought all that stuff looked good too.
Yeah, for sure. I would agree. And also, I mean, one of my favorite things in this movie is when Finn keeps grabbing Rey's hand and Rey keeps taking issue with it. I love every time that they do that. I think it probably happens 2 times, but
yeah,
I think it's so great.
Why do you like that so much?
It's just like at this, as soon as he sort of assumes that her having, like, being attached to him is helpful, she sort of immediately is like, no, this isn't, I'm better at this than you, you know, like I can do this.
You're a janitor.
Yeah, exactly. And she does so immediately, I think, both times. I really enjoy, and she's like almost confused by the fact that somebody would think that she's better off holding on to them, you know?
Yeah. Oh, and it's such an action movie staple of,
yeah,
of,
exactly,
the guy taking the girl's hand and then everything being okay, and it's shaken off in a very deliberate and obvious way.
Yeah, for sure.
Some people have kind of complained about Rey being kind of so good at what she does so quickly. And, you know, I think that also ties in with just kind of some, just being so big and having so many things in it. And, you know, you had such a big trouble with the Death Star. Well, this is a 10 times bigger Death Star. And,
yeah, it's not even a star, it's a star killer.
It's a star killer now, yeah. Yeah. Some people kind of thought that, you know, Rey kind of hadn't earned what she was able to do. Is that any of your issue with it, or is it kind of the other filmmaking stuff about just making things bigger, and instead of blowing up Alderaan, we'll blow up 4 planets, and kind of just, you know, things we've talked about in the Marvel movies, just jacking up the numbers and hoping that means emotions get jacked up, but that not really being a one-to-one ratio.
Yeah, it's much more the latter than the former.
Okay.
Because, okay, like, I mean, in a movie like this, I don't really care what rules of reality get broken, you know, as long as the movie that rule breaking is contained within is good, you know?
Yeah, okay, I get that. We talked about those introduction scenes, you know, the characters and vehicles getting their introductions and things like that. And you had also mentioned that none of the action scenes are really that appealing to you. Is there any kind of iconic moment outside of those reintroductions that you walked away with kind of still in your head? Like a moment, a visual, anything? I mean,
well, there's that one moment outside of, what's Lupita Nyong'o's character's name?
Maz Kantana or
okay,
something.
Maz.
Say Maz.
Yeah, out of Maz Kantana's cantina. That fight sequence that happens outside there, that one shot that kind of links Finn and Poe, who's flying in the air, and Finn, who doesn't know that that is Poe, doesn't, as far from what I recall, doesn't even know that Poe is still alive at that point.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the one sort of longer take within an action sequence that contains two different characters, you know, doing two different things, opposed, like, not you know, functioning together, but kind like functioning together in a larger sense, like they're both fighting the same battle. I thought that sequence was good. That one shot was good. As far as the action sequences, I know I mentioned them not being super engaging, but what we said about everything that happens on Tatooine in the first 35, 40 minutes. Faux Tatooine. Tatooine, two spelled...
with a two. Yeah.
That action sequence that ends in them finding the Millennium Falcon, that is the one that is good. That's one that I can get behind, even aside from, you know, the let go of my hand sort of things, comments that I mentioned already, liking just physically that action sequence is good.
I liked a lot of the aerial stuff. I like kind of aerial dogfights in general, I find. I thought even the kind of chase battle in the Millennium Falcon after they find it is good. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy their back and forth through a lot of this movie. I like them together. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was really good, and her kind of stalling it out and when the gun gets jammed. Like, I thought that was fun. I thought that really did keep the pace up and bring enough new stuff to, you know, the Millennium Falcon aerial fights that we've seen, you know, for so many movies now.
Yeah, that's fair. And I will say the aerial fights were never my favorite part of Star Wars. Just because, like, I mean, as much as you love Flyboys, I never saw it, you know, like... So
you're a Red Tails fan.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, Michael B. Jordan was in that one, so
that's true. What about kind of just the way that they've set up this trilogy, as far as even just by directors? I mean, to go Jar Jar Abrams for the first one, Rian Johnson and Colin Trevorrow.
Yeah.
Abrams has got some, you know, franchise cred. Mm-hmm.
And is a good director.
And I felt like you said you don't really like anything he's directed, but
I said I've liked every movie that he's directed. Mission Impossible 3, I think, is a very good action movie. I really like Super 8, and despite the fact that Super 8 is built exclusively around references to movies that I don't really like, I liked that movie. And I think like the last scene of Super 8 is something you can point to where it's really good filmmaking that gets across a really simple point. But J.J. Abrams does it in a really effective way. I liked both Star Trek movies as well. So I think that's all of them. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess we know that this was going to have to, you know, do so much about carrying over from Return of the Jedi into a whole new trilogy for, you know, a lot of new people. Empire Strikes Back is famously the dark, good one. So you've got Rian Johnson. And, you know, Return of the Jedi is the one that you never liked, even as a child. And it's directed by the guy who did Jurassic World, which I don't think you would have liked even as a child as well. So
it's fitting the mold.
Yeah, exactly. I just didn't know how you thought maybe about Abrams' place as him doing this first one and what that means.
I think he knows that there's just so much establishing to do, and you know, he's really shown himself with especially Star Trek, like sort of franchise reestablishing bona fides. And I think George Lucas actually is the person that wanted J.J. Abrams to do this movie, partially because, you know, he would have seen Super 8 by the time he sold Lucasfilm in 2012, and George Lucas is very he's very protective of his legacy in general. When the idea of selling Lucasfilm came up in a meeting with Bob Iger, Lucas was like, okay, I'm not ready to do that yet, but at some point. And then he immediately started getting the company ready to sell. Like, he eventually put Kathleen Kennedy, who he's worked with forever, in, you know, as the head of Lucasfilm, and he made sure the universe was in order in a way that he liked. And I assume preliminary talks of who he would want to take over the franchise happened at least internally at Lucasfilm, you know. And, you know, he's always been very protective of those things. And I feel like independently, both Disney and George Lucas would have wanted J.J. Abrams to be like the ideal guy. Like, he's really sort of... established himself as this guy that can, you know, restart a franchise and also has the respect of nerds everywhere, like the nerds that you need to have on board from minute one, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it was just, it just made so much sense, you know, to have him restart it. And because he is this guy that he likes to think big picture and he's not, you know, I saw, I don't even know if this is true, but that David Fincher's name was bandied about at one point. And the second I saw that, I was like, that's insane. Like, he would not have made a Star Wars movie. You know, he would have made a David Fincher movie that exists in the Star Wars universe, maybe. You know?
Yeah.
And it's just, like, to get... You need to have somebody that is able to make a good movie, but also is willing to take into account all of these ancillary elements that you have to care about with something like Star Wars, right? Especially, at least to get it established.
Right.
Which is why Rian Johnson can't do the first movie.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. And he's the perfect fit for the second one and not the third one. But it sounds like you're saying everything that J.J. Abrams is good at, and he did exactly all those things that you're listing that he's capable of, and mm-hmm. you've listed that you like all his movies, mm-hmm. but you don't like this movie.
No, I like this movie. I just like it in a way that... say like Star Trek, the first movie, right? It's very quippy and very enjoyable, and both Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto are very good together. But there's one, like, half an action scene that I found kind of notable in that movie, and it's the one where they're kind of skydiving. I don't know what the Star Trek equivalent of skydiving is, but that's a good sequence. And the rest of it, it's basically just good quips that are shot in an interesting way. And also, with Star Trek, I have absolutely no attachment to the franchise, like, as in haven't seen a full episode of any Star Trek series.
Right.
So anything that they did as fan service was totally new to me and just went right over my head, right? Whereas with Star Wars, I get all the references because that was a cultural dynamo that I did not skip over entirely in my childhood and liked it quite a bit in my childhood. So I get all of those references, you know, and so that takes away, like, there are probably a few things, more than a few things in Star Trek that I'm crediting to J.J. Abrams that Gene Roddenberry did, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like this fan service stuff that you missed out on for Star Trek makes it better, and it bogs down the ones that you actually get for a movie like Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something Alistair and I were talking about that yesterday, actually, where he thought the fan service was more upfront in Star Trek than it was in Star Wars. And I was just like, well, news to me. You know? So.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, and a lot of the things that I'm saying as far as it being logical that J.J. Abrams takes over the franchise, I'm viewing this as a big picture perspective from Disney. You know, like, I'm doing that horrible thing where I assume I'm a capitalist empire and and try and think about how they would prefer to do things, as opposed to thinking as a logical film fan who would 100% want to see that David Fincher movie, just yeah. like the David Lynch Return of the Jedi that never was is. Forever gonna make me sad.
Yes. Okay. All right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I'll allow you to have these opinions. Okay.
Thank you.
Before we hit the big red record button, we were sharing some laughs over the emo Kylo Ren Twitter feed.
Yeah.
How'd you feel about Kylo as our villain and all the villains? We've really just talked about good guys so far.
I feel like we gotta talk about the future directors first, right?
Oh, yeah.
Just
sure.
A little bit, because we kind of just straight away. I left The Force Awakening, or The Force Awakens, less optimistic about Rian Johnson because of how many beats The Force Awakens hit. I really hope that they did that in this one to sort of give them the freedom to be really creative in the next one. That's what I'm really hopeful for. Mm-hmm. I believe...
And that's believable. I'm not certain of it, but it could be a way that the narrative of this really forms.
Exactly. A sort of like one for them, one for me sort of thing. Right.
Then one for David Fincher.
God willing. That's kind of like the best way I can look at it, you know? And that's what I'm really hoping for. And I believe Rian Johnson's writing episode 8 as well, not directing it, but writing it. One thing that I was thinking about today. Can you name the directors of Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi?
That Irvin Kershman, whatever. He's always had a weird name.
Kershner, but yeah.
Yeah, just, there you go. And Steven Soderbergh. No, no, I don't know.
I said I didn't like Return of the Jedi.
Georges.
It's Richard Marquand. Which, and I don't mean to put you on the spot like that.
Richard Marquand.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, part of the reason nobody knows his name is that I don't think he made another movie, and he died 4 years later of a stroke. But and I think Irvin Kershner never made another movie, actually, now that I think about it. But, you know, it's not like these movies were directed by cream of the crop talent. You know, Irvin Kershner
like
was...
Colin Trevorrow.
Well, yeah. Well, that's the thing. What I'm saying is that Rian Johnson is immediately the best director that... even without having directed a Star Wars movie, he's the best director that has ever directed a Star Wars movie, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see what he's able to do. And I feel like a lot of my filmmaking complaints about this movie, which is that this movie is just close up, close up, close up, close up, close up, like just nonstop. And it's cut way too fast. And there doesn't seem to be a, you know, sort of thoughtfulness thread run throughout scenes where like they knew what they were doing on set, and hand in hand with that come a few of those CGI snap zooms that I hate so much.
Oh man, that one in the Millennium Falcon one. It... Thought of you right away.
Yeah. I'm glad.
It's like, oh, this is building something. Oh, he's not gonna like that.
Yeah, I'm glad I've corrupted your brain to think of me immediately upon seeing a horrible zoom decision. But like, that's the type of thing. There are three zooms in this movie, and they're all in CGI shots like that, right? And it just shows that it was something that wasn't thought of on set. It's like zooms are not necessarily a part of this movie until they get into CGI. And it's like, well, we can put a zoom here. It's like, okay, sure, put a zoom there. You know, like, you know, it's not a part of the design early on, whereas Rian Johnson is just so visually creative and so talented in the way that he is able to shoot scenes engagingly and also tie them together well in editing. That I'm really hopeful that he is able to kind of stretch his legs a little bit, because I mean, he's going to have at least four times the budget that he's ever had. You know, Looper is his biggest budget, and I don't think that topped 50 million, you know? So I just really hope that the weight of the franchise doesn't crush his talent, basically.
Quick sidebar?
Yeah, of course.
I don't know if I agree with you about those zooms, and not that I disagree about their quality. Just I hate when everyone just says J.J. Abrams lens flare every chance they get, but don't you think it's something like that, where it's just kind of this little bit of visual flair that might have been thought about the whole time? Like, you really...
I think there would be more than three zooms in the movie if you did, you know? And
But more than three would be so much. That would make zooms the lens flare of The Force Awakens, for sure. And I think he really learned a lesson about kind of minor visual flares like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're... I mean, if you're only going to do three zooms, then don't do any, you know? Like... And have
that's awful advice.
What?
That seems like awful advice.
Well, I mean, none of them had any sort of meaning. It was just something instead of nothing. It was like, we're not ready for the shot of the Millennium Falcon going into the Star Destroyer to be over. So how can we keep the audience invested for another half a second? We'll just do a quick push zoom. Yeah.
I think you're undercrediting the amount of thought and planning that would go into this.
I don't think I am. There's okay. Absolutely a lot of thought and planning into those things, but that's the type of thing that you can throw on the end of the shot easily without adding in any additional time, you know?
Yeah, no, I understand how it can be used as kind of a crutch like that, but mm-hmm. I think it would be something more like the lens flare, and I think... to do three of them and say that's a bad idea, but let's do 10 of them and now it's an artistic choice is, I don't think that holds much water.
Okay, well, I don't think the zoom added anything to any of the shots that it's used. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I know that's the first time they do it, that that shot that we've specifically talked about. I can't think of the other couple. But I remember the second I saw that first one, I was like, well, I'm going to focus on thinking about these next time if they do these again.
Yeah, I'm not saying that there was like this deeper thematic reason for it and that it was, you know, part of this grand scheme to communicate something else through cinematography. But I don't think it's as after the fact as you make it out to be.
All right. Well, I disagree.
These aren't the droids you're looking for. Okay, moving on.
Yeah.
We were talking about Rian Johnson, I think.
Well, that was pretty much all the points I have about directors, because Colin Trevorrow hasn't proven himself to be a good director, so I don't really have thoughts.
It's so crazy to me that they're just... And I know Lucas fits in this category the first time, you know, when he made A New Hope, but just giving the, you know, as they say, the keys to the Lamborghini to these directors under, what, 35, who really haven't done that much. Like, I mean,
Well, Rian Johnson's 42, I think, and J.J. Abrams is in his 40s as well.
Yeah, I meant more Colin Trevorrow, and to have done so few movies, and I like everything that I've seen of Rian Johnson's, which I think is most of it.
I think you've seen all of it. There's only three movies.
Yeah, there might be some short film in there.
Oh, yeah, okay. There's some music videos and stuff.
Yeah. No, I think that's it's crazy to me that they're doing that. But is that just kind of culture speeding up and needing to stay with younger people?
I think it's honestly, I think part of it is that financial. Like, I think, although I guess Colin Trevorrow after Jurassic World wouldn't come cheap. So no, I don't know what the answer to that is. I think it's just kind of like Marvel did it. So like, you know, tried these people that haven't necessarily, and this isn't all youth based, you know, Kenneth Branagh directed Thor, you know, he had never directed a big movie, but it's like, well, we'll just try somebody that fits this mold, you know, regardless of whether or not they've directed a big movie, we'll just have somebody that we trust to handle the emotional stuff and hope that them in the second unit can figure out the action sequences. I mean, like, yeah, Batman Begins is a great example of that, right? Christopher Nolan got that movie because Warner Brothers trusted him to do Bruce Wainwright, and the fight sequences showed, you know, like the fight sequences in Batman Begins are nobody's favorite action scenes, you know?
Yeah. And the Russos had worked, but not in this field.
Yeah, so exactly. Much. And like the Russos just somehow happened to be good at making action sequences. So bonus for them, you know?
I think it's because they try really hard at everything they do, but
okay.
That's not the point.
I would love everybody to try really hard at everything they do all the time. I feel like the world would be a better place for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have a candidate for a Jar Jar or an Anakin or anything that you think time will frown upon very poorly?
I don't think so. Do you?
No, I mean,
not putting Oscar Isaac in the movie enough. I think time will frown upon that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can't see what it is either. I mean, there's going to be forgettable things like Maz and things like that, but nothing that was so glaring. I mean, we try not to discuss these movies too much before. You sent me some jokes about how cute you found BB-8.
Yeah, I love the design of BB-8. I think it's super cool.
It was cool, and I know it had probably a bit more cutesy personality than you wanted it to, but I think, like most things with this movie, they towed the line pretty well on that kind of stuff. And I think part of it is it starts kind of dark, so it kind of wins over the people that who were trying to find it. Who were looking for a Jar Jar and were trying to find a super kiddy, toyetic, as they say, kind of movie. You know, that scene with, you know, where we meet Poe and Max von Sydow and, you know, Kylo Ren. I think that was also a good scene. And I think that was good. And, you know, the blood being smeared on a stormtrooper.
The blood smear was a very good decision.
Yeah. And
love that.
I mean, okay, for a few reasons. For storytelling purposes, now we have this visual indication of which one is Finn, or at that point, FN 420 or whatever he was.
Yeah.
So visually we can follow this person among groups of thousands that are dressed the exact same and you can't see their face. And for a remarkably bloodless franchise up to this point, I think that did a good job of saying, this is a bit different. You know, there's going to be a little bit more with this one.
Yeah.
You know, we can, it's going to be a bit heavier. And just those shots, you know, in those dark, you know, troop transports of, you know, just white stormtroopers and black backgrounds and a lot of shadows and very darkly lit scenes. You know, the attack being at nighttime, just more darkness and a mostly unshown, but still pretty heavy civilian massacre. It did a good job of being, you know, your kid's not going to cry so much that you're going to have to leave the theater and miss this movie, but it just kind of set the tone that it's just going to be heavier and it's just going to be that much darker. And I thought that was a really good example of, you know, hitting all your quadrants, if you want to think like the capitalist machine again.
Yeah.
I thought that was a good one. And then, you know, things lighten up and things do get kind of cutesy and fun after, and there's not that much darkness for the rest of the movie. But, yeah, I really did think that was kind of a good way to bring some gravity and depth to everything. And Kylo Ren freezing the laser was pretty cool too.
Sorry, what did you say? Oh, that was awesome. Freezing the laser bolt?
Yeah.
Oh, that was great.
You're like, how have we not done this yet? We had this technology for the last three movies at least.
Yeah. I agree with pretty much everything you've said just now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And you just kind of wanted that for maybe two more hours?
I think I read that Michael Arndt, the original screenwriter for this movie, his original draft, you know, parts of which end up in this movie for sure. I don't know for sure. What do I know? But presumably. His original draft initially revolved a lot more around the three new characters and really used Han, Leia, and Luke as ancillary characters. Not that Luke isn't an ancillary character in this movie. And same with Leia, actually. And that, I really would have loved to see the movie really focus on the three. And I think the next movie will, just because I think killing Han is a very good idea for the franchise going forward.
I honestly believe that's part of Harrison Ford's involvement in just this one.
Oh, I guarantee, like, that's the whole thing. His whole, you know, every time he signed up to make a new Star Wars, he was like, can you kill me in this one? He's always wanted to die in these movies just because he doesn't want to make these movies. And, I mentioned
breaking his foot, I'm sure, didn't sweeten
well,
the deal.
Yeah, exactly. part of the reason I kind of expected him to die going into this movie was like the seem like he's got some sort of like glee in him now promoting this movie, and I was just like he just showed up at a before the movie was released, he showed up at like some sort of sizzle reel presentation and. In Melbourne, I think it was, where it's just 10 minutes of effects. And he was just sitting in the audience and then unannounced at the end, just stood up. Like nobody knew he was there. He just stood up and said, there's a lot more where that came from. And I'm just like, this is very out of character, Mr. Ford. And
that's not something you do when you know you have to do it twice more. And
yeah, exactly.
Five more years.
When you have to go back to England, to Pinewood Studios in January.
Yeah.
That was something that just kind of led to me being like, oh yeah, he's definitely gonna die. And I think the fact that killing off the one character that really can still carry a movie regardless of whether or not he's showing his age, which I do think he does show his age a bit in this movie, like there are some moments of absolute vintage Harrison Ford, but there are some also some moments where he's just not as good as he once was, you know, like
what do you mean showing his age?
There's just some stuff where it's just like, he just looks old. And I mean, he is, but,
he is old.
I know he is old, but he's doing these things that a 71 year old man would never conceivably be asked to do, you know, in any capacity. Right.
When he asked Ray to download something onto his phone.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, I have a Zoom. Does that still work? No, and just, and I mean that in some of his line readings as well. Like, it's just, he doesn't, he's not as natural as he seemed to be line for line back in the day. There are some moments where you get absolute vintage Ford when Finn says, we'll just use the Force, and Han saying, that's not how the Force works. Like, that's just pure 1980 Harrison Ford, you know?
If at any point in my life, if you had given me 1,000-to-1 odds that the line, that's not how the Force works, and any appears in any Star Wars movie ever, I wouldn't, you know?
Yeah, like, exactly.
That was such a good little line that killed, and rightfully so.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I don't even remember the point that we were on. Oh, yeah, that killing Han removes the ability for any of the older characters to still carry a movie. And I think that's really promising going forward.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, we're going to get more, we're going to get a lot more Luke, though.
Yeah, exactly. But, and I'm fine with that, but I think we'll never get more Luke than we'll get Rey, you know? And,
yeah.
And
is it going to be a Yoda thing? He'll be number 2/8 and then fade out?
I think it'll be a Yoda thing in some capacity. I don't know that they'd necessarily do the exact same or I hope they don't do the exact same thing that they did with Yoda. I think it'll be more of a two-hander than Yoda ever was, if only because Luke still has the capacity to walk around and hold a lightsaber and stuff, you know, whereas Yoda was a puppet.
It's going to be more of a Rocky Creed kind of situation.
Yeah, exactly. I cannot wait for all the wheelies and the
speeder wheelies, wheels.
I think that's kind of the way it'll go, and I think that's good for the franchise, okay. And good for the next movie. And yeah. I mean, this is the point of the movie where I say something good about it, the point of the podcast where I say something good about the movie. I like pretty much everything about Rey. I don't have any complaints.
That she's cute as a button.
Sure.
Just okay to go back to. I mean, maybe we'll get to Rey later. How do you feel about the idea of Luke going to the dark side? I guess, or being revealed as such in the next movie.
I would love it. That sounds very promising.
Yeah, and it seems. I mean, it seemed like an idea that you would like, but at the same time, it seems too on the rails about. What was done in the original trilogy, and you know, finding out that Luke kind of has this dark past, just by the very nature of Darth Vader being his father. Spoiler alerts! Sorry, guys. Spoiler alert. But I think it does so many things. I think it spins so much around because I think it. You know, the original trilogy built Luke up to be kind of the ultimate good guy, kind of able to overcome his father's darkness and things like that. How selfless he was and all the things he did for, you know, the rebellion and all these things. And then, you know, everyone's excitement about seeing him at the end of The Force Awakens. I think that would be such a good turn just because... for so many reasons, but it does provide us with something that The Empire Strikes Back did, which was this really downbeat note to leave on. But that's what makes, or that's what I think has a lot to do with Empire Strikes Back being the one that is so critically popular and the one that ultimately stands the test of time. And A New Hope's just undeniable because of how much it introduced and how much it changed cinema.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Hollywood and the way movie theaters function and so many of these things. But it's Empire Strikes Back that's kind of the artistic achievement. And to do something interesting from a narrative perspective in a movie that in a franchise that I think everyone is saying is too stale, too derivative, too redundant. It seems to me to be the best way out. And the fact that I can predict it, maybe it's not, but
yeah.
It's appealing in so many ways.
Exactly. The only thing that makes it unappealing is the fact that we're talking about it right now.
We're super smart.
You are super smart.
We have a podcast. We're pretty bright people.
We have a podcast that like two people think is good. So we're clearly geniuses. Yeah. No, I do think that's a good idea. And also, what made it's different, right? Because with this theoretical scenario that you have proposed, we're seeing Luke, who we first see as like this, you know, this beacon of light, a new hope, turning evil, right? Whereas the twist with Empire Strikes Back was that when Darth Vader is introduced, he's just darkness. He's pure evil, evil personified, and we have no other hints about anything else about him. And the twist is that Darth Vader at one point was good. And that's the twist of the core. It's that they're related, but also that this just horrifying person at one point was not.
Just that the idea that there is no such thing as pure evil, I think, is more terrifying than this completely, you know, demonic, nefarious entity that is pure evil. It's the idea that anything good in the world can go as dark as that, I think, is what's so frightening about that notion.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. And the thing that, you know, we talked about how the generational thing and throughout Star Wars kind of bores me throughout these movies, or not necessarily bores me, but doesn't necessarily make me give it any more leeway. That is something generationally, there we go, I did it, throughout the movies that would be really cool, right? Because the crux of Luke's story in The Empire Strikes Back is that he doesn't want to become who his father was. And, he doesn't want to turn evil, but the whole movie is built around him not wanting to, initially starts with him wanting to find his father, but then once he finds his father, he doesn't want to turn into his father. And with this turn in the proposed next movie written by James it would just be
I'm a story consultant with Ryan.
Oh, story consultant? Yeah. Okay, I couldn't remember your exact credit. did you get EP? That would be that exact theme continued, but in a way that would be interesting, you know? And I know I feel like we've said towing the line or the fine line between like a million times throughout this podcast, but that would be exactly on the line. It would be Joseph Gordon-Levitt in The Walk. It would be just going back and forth between the World Trade Center towers, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it would be...
That is our second Robert Zemeckis reference in this podcast.
Well, that's the thing. Been like a box of chocolates, like no, that's just more Zemeckis.
Hold on, there's a feather just floating through my room right now. Sorry,
no, and I mean, I will admit, I'm not the I did read that somewhere else. I'm not the origin of that idea, but there's so many things in Jedi that don't quite add up unless you just kind of glaze over them. Mm-hmm. You know, he kind of does everything. The Emperor tells him to do, which is, give in to hate, strike me down. Yoda says, your training's not complete. If you go and save your friends, you know, you're not going to become a true Jedi, and that leaves you open to turn to the dark side. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. He does disobey Yoda and play into, you know, what the most dark character we have is. Mm-hmm. So it does. It makes a ton of sense. As much as it seems so antithetical to Luke, kind of all the stepping stones are in place there. And as much as that would be something interesting, it does seem completely feasible. And I mean, that's the part of me, as you said, that makes it seem like that wouldn't be that interesting or it wouldn't be that impossible is the fact that any of us can predict it.
But yeah, exactly.
The fact that I still believe that if it went down like that, it would be very interesting, and I think it would be such a cool thing to do with something that everyone is saying is too cookie cutter at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, not everybody, just people, idiots like me, the grumps,
the Scrooges,
yeah, the Krampus.
on the topic of Darth Vader and Dark Luke, Kylo Ren,
yeah, I don't know. I kind of go back and forth about it. Like, anytime he had the mask on, I'm cool with it. There's just something about Adam Driver's face and just the way he performs when we can see his face. And maybe it's just I can't remove him from his girl's character, and this one's on me.
Yeah, and I don't have very much of that, so.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. There was just something about the way that he kind of, he would talk when he didn't have his helmet on that I couldn't vibe with, you know? He definitely has a villainous face. I'll give him that. But there was some, like, he looked, I don't know.
How about just the idea of having a helmet that you don't need?
I thought that was cool. And actually when he took the helmet off, I was like, ooh, interesting. It was a stormtrooper thing again, you know? Whereas when Darth Vader takes off the helmet, you know, we get a little glimpse of it in Empire, but I think the only time you properly see him without a helmet on, is at the end of Return of the Jedi, you know, and that they saved that moment for the third movie of the trilogy. But in this one, they're just, it's just something he nonchalantly does around the 1 hour mark, you know? I thought that was cool. Yeah,
and I thought that was as small as it is, I thought that was a genuine surprise to see his face.
Yes, I would agree.
And especially under, as you said, you know, fairly voluntary circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I thought that was good. I think those are my whole points, or all my points about him.
Okay, yeah. I mean...
I'm still unsure of whether or not I liked his performance, you know? But that mask thing was cool, for sure.
Yeah, and... I think that there is something, let's say, cool about the idea of, I think this ties into what we had said before about Darth Vader being Luke's father, just that this idea of pure evil not being pure evil from the get-go, kind of having this, you know, neutral or good even, but neutral's fine source, is to aspire to evil, you know, to not be this damaged, but to go for it. And that moment with Han on the bridge when you said that, you know, that didn't really do much for you, I think it is an interesting point that he's at. You know, he says that if, you know, he feels that he's kind of split between two things right now. And if he goes off with Han, if he chooses good at that moment, that there is this chance for the rest of his life that maybe I made the wrong choice. Mm-hmm. Maybe I am a bad person, but I'm just pretending to be this good person. And even if I fight for the good side of this, maybe that's not who I truly am. But if I kill my dad right now, I know who I am. Mm-hmm. I'm bad, and I'm always going to be bad. And that's, like, I've gone to the dark side in kind of a way that there is no return. There's no recovering from.
Yeah, there's not a lot of coming back from patricide.
No, there's not. And I thought that was kind of an interesting... an interesting point characteristically that I haven't seen beat into the ground a lot. And I thought that was kind of something new that this movie had provided in within a film that everyone's saying, a lot of people are saying is it's nothing new at all.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. I think his sort of struggle there is interesting. I just sort of, my complaints about that movie that moment are mostly tied to the fact that, you know, Han Solo's death is so well telegraphed, I find, in that scene.
Oh, completely telegraphed. Oh, that bridge with no arm rails. Come on.
Yeah. And, the way the sound drops out, except for the wind, you know, all that stuff, which is something I actually really enjoyed. It felt like a nice quiet nature moment where John Williams wasn't attacking me. That didn't happen a lot throughout that movie, you know, and I mean that politely. John Williams' attacks in Star Wars movies are generally pretty pleasant.
Yes.
Yeah.
That will give you that.
Yeah. But yes, I would agree that the decision he is making there is interesting, if not necessarily the way that decision is presented on screen.
Even just the idea of, you know, wanting to be evil, is that worse than being pure evil and having no
say
into it?
Exactly.
You know?
Like being sort of born and, you know, being like anybody else. And for some reason, this is what you like actively want and desperately want, you know?
Yeah.
So like you may or may not waver a bit in that scene, depending on how you want to read it. But the vast majority of the movie points to him wanting it, you know, like Michael Jordan wants an NBA championship in 1988, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, I had a bunch of fun with, you know, emo Kylo Ren. I think there's so much funny stuff in it, too. But I think it's good that it wasn't this he wasn't a super badass right away. Yes. You know, it, for all the complaints about everything coming too quickly and being jammed into this, I guess it kind of bugs me when people it bugs me when people say that, you know, everything was put forward and given to you right away and you don't have to build for anything. And also, why wasn't Kylo Ren a total badass yet? You know, it's, you know, it just seems like trying to get it both ways. And, you know, Darth Vader in the first one was still taking orders and...
he's only in the movie for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, and just kind of, you know, looked at as kind of this relic of this religion that doesn't seem to have much sway anymore. And, you know, now the big boys are going to take care of things. And, yeah, you look badass, but we're going to make all the decisions and we're going to do all this. And he has to overcome that. And I think that... If we're looking 2-3 movies down the road, it is good that there's still, you know, not a hard ceiling on how evil this person can be.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think that was something that was handled well.
Yeah.
How about Captain Snoke, if that name even means anything to you?
Is he a captain? I thought he was higher up than that. I guess I was just thinking Emperor. Like, we're talking hologram, right? Andy Serkis?
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought the hologram was a bit large for my tastes. And I don't know. I guess I just didn't really have much in the way of thoughts about him. You know? He was kind of just there still influencing things, but not really physically there. So I didn't pay as much attention to him, I guess.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of like every bland CGI villain that we've run into in a lot
of movies. Exactly. It's Thanos, you know.
Yeah, it just makes you so forgettable and hard to take seriously. And my suspicion and honestly hope is that this is a little build to a greater villain. But yeah, I mean, it's I kind of had to be reminded that that was even a character after the movie, which isn't a good sign unless it's kind of a subtle way to get to a bigger thing.
Yeah, for sure. I liked Donald Gleason. I forget his character's name, Grand Moff Tarkin. I thought he was quite good, and I thought his rousing the troops speech scene was quite good.
His triumph of the will.
Yeah, I mean, and the fact that the stormtroopers get so close to doing the Heil Hitler at the end of that speech. Like, they just put their fists up in the air. It's like, hold on, what's happening? Oh, it's just a fist. It's okay. My only complaint about that sequence is that they cut away from Donald Gleason during his highest point. I don't know if they were mixing takes or what, but they cut to a wide shot at a weird point when he seems to really be giving it his all. And I thought he was really good in a role that, you know, limits anybody, you know? Like, there's just not a lot to do.
No.
Yeah.
It's all... Kirk talking or yell.
Yeah, exactly. And having weird sideburns.
The most restricting of acting moves. Yeah. How about R2?
No. Thanks. He's in the movie for so little that I have no thoughts.
Even on the kind of checklist?
Well, I thought it's kind of like Luke, right? Where... it's cool that he's in the movie as little as he is. He? Am I supposed to call R2 he? Like, what's the nomenclature here?
I'm wondering if they ever do call him by a pronoun throughout the movies.
We'll just go it. I'll go it. Is that?
Yeah.
What are we calling? I mean, it's
he's
as well?
Played by a male, and R2 is so close to Arthur.
Yeah.
let's go with it.
Okay. Yeah, and it's just sort of the Luke Skywalker thing where they don't show Luke until the very end, and they don't show a functioning R2 until very near the end. And you know, I don't have thoughts about how they used it other than the fact that it's cool that he doesn't have a super prominent role, especially like you know, despite those jokes I sent you about BB-8 via text message, I have no complaints about BB-8 in the movie. Even the few cutesy things they did actually made me laugh. The thumbs up when he's talking to Finn, like, I thought that was funny. And is the type of joke that is very easy for me to not be on board with, but I laughed. And I think that's as cutesy as it gets with him. or it, sorry, my apologies, yeah, everybody, throughout the movie. And yeah, I think multiple droids rolling around would have been a little bit much, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, I think that he, you know, three more jokes like that.
Oh, and I'm off board. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I'm yawning too. Yeah. They kind of kept it on a short leash, and I thought that was good.
Yeah. And same with 3PO. They use 3PO exactly as much as I want 3PO to be used. Like, in a way that he doesn't cross over from... he is used just as much as I want 3PO to be used. In that he's able to tell a few jokes without being grating, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. I was just... It's interesting. R2's role throughout this whole franchise up until this point... 3PO kind of had a reset on his, or factory reset on his personality at one point. R2 is really the one that is the most consistently active character throughout all of these movies, incredibly. I mean, we've got Ben Kenobi through a lot of these too.
But in very minimal parts in the second and third, you know.
Kenobi?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's what I mean. In R2, it's from the beginning with you know, Anakin building him. And I know it's not screen time or obviously dialogue that he dominates in, but stealing plans and delivering secrets and killing people and facilitating escapes and repairing ships and saving the lives of heroes without them knowing it. He has a very, you know, tangible effect on this whole franchise as far as, you know, the way the narrative is concerned. And people do know him and do like him and everything, but how much effect that he has in, you know, sneaking the lightsaber in to get out of Jabba's palace and so many things. He's incredibly important when you look at, you know, what effect that he has. And I thought that that was one point in this movie that they seem to show the most restraint on. I mean, we get boops and we see him and things like that. But he gets a less grand entrance than the Millennium Falcon, who is, you know, an inanimate being. And
yeah.
He doesn't seem to have a personality or a voice or anything. And I thought that was one time that they really did hold back. And once again, he's completely central. So much of this movie revolves around the 5% of the map that BB-8 has, where once we find out R2-D2 had 95% of it, seems kind of insignificant. But I thought that was a really good example of this franchise having a lot to offer. And even when it seems to be so upfront and seems to be pandering the most, that there is something, you know, kind of deeper, a character that is later in the series who is obviously going to provide so much more for this franchise and movies to come, and even just in the narrative of this movie, doesn't take up a lot of screen time, but does so much and is the one that makes that, you know, really powerful, memorable scene of, you know, Rey and Luke meeting at long last. Mm-hmm. Who does more than anybody else to facilitate that, you know, from a purely data perspective.
Yeah, for sure.
I thought that was a really interesting thing. And, you know, to put that so back heavy was kind of just this, to me, this late confidence from the filmmakers to say somewhere away in Disney/Lucasfilm, this is all planned out. We've got this under control. And even the things that aren't the splashy spectacle things up front, there's a bigger plan for.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you thought about that.
I would say there's certainly a bigger plan than, you know, at Disney, at the ranch, whatever you want to call whatever Lucasfilm is now.
Modesto.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, I think that is definitely indicative of it. Don't you think it's a little deus ex machina at the end then, with R2 just sort of popping back to life?
Okay, we've already got two ex machina actors in.
Well, now we've got the deus.
I don't... not in a problematic way.
I would agree. I'm not asking that because I think it's problematic. I just, it's definitely a Deus Ex Machina sort of thing, but.
Well, but
or 95% of one.
No, because BB-8 could have had all the plans the whole time. Because this whole movie is, you know, the Resistance or the First Order or whoever it may be, you know, Rey earlier on, chasing or protecting this BB-8. And if he had 100% of the plans, nothing much really changes. Mm-hmm. There's no point, you know, this, you know, second act moment where they find out that he doesn't have everything and now they've got to go for the headquarters and now all these people are in danger that wouldn't have been in danger. That doesn't exist here. That's not a concern. If BB-8 had 100% of the plans, it still could play out largely the way that it does, but it's this R2, it's this constant. It's what made Star Wars interesting and unique from the beginning, and he's got this in his back pocket. And I know exactly what you mean about that kind of being cheap, but it doesn't come in and solve all the problems, which is what's so infamous about the Deus Ex Machina. It's something where it's planned ahead. It's beyond this, I'm under a deadline and I need a way out of this problem that I've written. You know, R2-D2 isn't a writer painting himself into a corner and needing a quick way out, which I think is what that's most infamous for. Mm-hmm. It's a sign that there's a lot going on and that there's a lot that's been figured out. And in this massive universe, you know, whether it's the galaxy far, far away or the Disney Lucasfilm Star Wars universe, that there are still things hidden and there are still things to come and there are still things planned out. And the spectacle and the bright colors and the splashiness and the fights are what sells tickets and what brings in all four quadrants. But there is still something in this series that I think is smarter and richer and I don't want to say deeper because I don't think that's correct, but grander and more operatic. And people call this a space opera all the time. And it that's so out of... We talk about popcorn blockbusters, describe them as an opera, but somehow Star Wars walks that, you know, to steal a phrase we've used 20 times already tonight, walks that fine line and makes it something a bit different and a bit bigger and... a bit more, and I think that's where it succeeds.
Yeah, and Nolan always called the Batman movies very operatic as well. So yes, I see your point. Yeah, and I will say that despite the fact that it doesn't affect me in any capacity, I'll never be upset seeing somebody sitting in a movie theater seat being unbelievably excited for a movie, you know, like regardless of what the movie is, like, and how I may feel about the fact that, you know, the nostalgia's kind of not the best, and I wish they were excited for something new, but the fact that you know, there are all these people sitting in movie theaters last Friday and just excited about seeing a movie, like, that will always make me happy. You know, just seeing movies be an important part of culture is always cool. And I saw a lot of that this week, and that's cool. You know?
Yeah, I know. And I think you don't want to hear the people clap during the movie, but I think it warms your heart that somewhere people are clapping for pre-recorded, well put together cinema somewhere.
Yeah. Yes, and you know, going into the movie, I knew I was gonna be with a more boisterous audience than, you know, when I go to see Carol tomorrow or whatever. but although that would be really
we'll
funny.
See. Yeah, fingers exactly. crossed.
Yeah. Maybe there will be a big Kyle Chandler fan in the audience that just can't keep it together.
You?
No, I'm pretty good at keeping it together. I kept it together for the Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah, yeah, and as much as I talk badly about, well, and I saw Vertigo at the Lightbox on Saturday, and people applauded at the end, and I would like roll my eyes. I was like, literally everybody involved in this movie except Kim Novak is dead now. You know, like, so like that kind of, you know, that was kind of like, well, it's you're clapping to say that yes, the movie that is often voted on as the best movie in the history of the world is something you approve of, you know, like good work, you know. Whereas Star Wars, it's more of a sort of an excitement thing. And as somebody that's not very excitable, but has at one point in my life been very excitable, I think it's cool. And even just like I was thinking about when first time I saw The Dark Knight, and this is a feeling I still get every once in a while when I'm watching a new movie. It'll probably happen with the new Bourne movie where it happened with Interstellar, actually.
Jeremy Renner's back?
Yeah. Can you believe it? Sidequel, too.
The Hawkeye?
The Hawkeye. Oscar Isaac's in The Bourne Legacy. I learned that today. I forgot about that. But yeah, it's just sort of the experience of sitting in a movie theater, and as the first minute of the movie is happening, you're like, I can't believe this exists. I can't believe I'm like sitting here watching a new Star Wars movie, a new Nolan movie, a new Bourne movie, you know, like when at one point you thought it was totally gone, you know. And my hope for those types of things is always that they'll do more new stuff than they do in The Force Awakens. I'm not too concerned about that being a problem with the Bourne franchise. I feel like it's going to be a bit more of a departure than the Force Awakens, but
the Bourne departure.
It's just him going on a trip and nothing really all that bad happens. It's like Couples Retreat again with him.
Headphones don't work.
But yeah, I don't know. There's just something, if anything's going to warm my heart, it's just the idea of somebody sitting in a movie theater being really excited about watching a movie. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, cool. Well, let's get all BB-8 and roll out of here.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.